the Ten Commandments and all of the law that follows is God's, a God-based moral code. It doesn't just say that certain behaviors are unwise or unhelpful, but it commands that God says, do this, don't do that, and implies that, number one, God sees what we do or don't do, that, number two, God measures what we do or don't do, and thirdly, God rewards or punishes what we do or don't do. We're finally into Exodus chapter 20 and the Ten Commandments. You say, well, that's good, because we started this 24 messages ago, and we gave you the background. Now we're on the main subject of the series here, as we look today at the first commandment. C.S. Lewis, in the book The Abolition of Man, said that man agrees on a morality because the principles are implanted in the hearts and mind of every person. But without a God-based moral code, it's difficult to answer the question, why? Why don't we murder? Why don't we commit adultery? Why do we worship just one God? You need something more than just the mind and the thinking of man in response to the moral demands of the law. For centuries, men have tried to establish good moral codes, reasons for living, but always apart from God. In 1988, a vocal Ted Turner, you might know him of the TBS media mogul, he came up with 10 voluntary initiatives. He said nobody likes the word commandment. Nobody likes to be told do this or don't do that. So these are voluntary things that will replace the 10 commandments. Let me just share you with what he said. I promise to love and respect the planet Earth. That's just like the first commandment, right? Oh, wait, no God there. Okay. Number two, I promise to treat all persons everywhere with dignity, respect, and friendliness. Thirdly, I promise to have no more than 2 children. I hope that he kept that promise. I promise to use my best efforts to preserve what's left of nature's world. I pledge to use as little non-renewable resources as possible. I pledge to use as little toxic chemicals, pesticides, or poisons as possible. I promise to contribute to those less fortunate than myself, to help them have clean air, clean water, adequate food, health care, housing, education. I support the use of military force by the United Nations. I support the total elimination of nuclear, chemical, biological weapons of mass destruction, and support the United Nations to improve the conditions of all mankind. Today, we will not examine Ted Turner's 10 voluntary initiatives, but focus instead on what God said is an absolute command. For he said in Exodus 20, verses 1 to 3, that God spoke these words saying, I am Yahweh, I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. We know that as commandment 1 of the 10 commandments. Let's look first of all at this commandment in light of the Old Testament, of what it meant to the Jews who were standing there listening to the voice of God. Can you imagine that? You know, when somebody's speaking and they're an important person, I want to sit and listen. I have very poor hearing. My wife says I never listen to her. At least I think that's what she says. And my deafness is overwhelming sometimes. But if the president is speaking, or the weather forecasters about the hurricanes are speaking, if some great preacher is speaking, I pay attention. You'll see me around some, I'll just kind of go with my hand up to my ear. I want to make sure I catch every word. These people are standing. Remember last two messages from Exodus 19? These people are standing now at the base of Mount Sinai with the thunder and the trumpets and the smoke and the fire and the just an awesome display. They are just waiting and they listen, and this is what God said. In ancient Egypt, where they'd come from, men worshiped many gods. Yahweh had set himself up against these supposed deities. And we noticed in our study of the plagues 15 messages ago that God was using each of the plagues to destroy one of the gods of Egypt. And so after debasing them, God says, I want to remind you who I am, what I've done. I am the only God. That I am above, I am the God who is above nature. Look at the spectacle going on around Mount Sinai. That's me. I'm doing this. It's not a God of the sun or the sky or the clouds or whatever it might be. I am a personal God. I'm not the force. I'm not a dehumanized power. I'm a God who cares and is personal. Look at what I did. I split the Red Sea. I gave you manna and quail. I led you with a pillar of cloud and fire and brought you to this holy mountain now 2 months after the Exodus began. For God is good, doing what is best for his people. God is love. He said in chapter 19 that he carried them on eagle's wings through the wilderness to this very place. And that he is holy and demands the people be holy. So this is the clear foundation of the first commandment. He doesn't just spring on them, well, you got to worship me. He says, look at me, listen, let yourself be filled with not only the senses around you, but the knowledge of what I've done. I have the right to speak. I have the right to give you commands because I fulfilled my promise. Moses thought he could deliver the Israelites. Remember when they were in affliction? And he saw them being persecuted. He went out and killed an Egyptian and buried him in a sand dune. Moses fled 40 years out in the wilderness, learning the lesson that he couldn't deliver. But God could. And so he had an obligation to obey God. G. Campbell Morgan said, God did not promulgate a code of laws for the children of Israel while they were in bondage, telling them that if they would obey it, he would deliver them. What did he do? He brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of bondage, and then gave them the law. What a beautiful picture of his grace. So many people are trying to keep the law to gain favor with God or gain salvation. How many people do you know that when you say, are you going to heaven? They say, well, I keep the Ten Commandments. I'd like to have them just say, okay, would you tell me which commandments you keep and see how many of the 10 they even know. But I won't ask you because I don't want to embarrass you today because we can say that, but we often do not understand even what we're saying. So positively, I'm the Lord God. I'm the one who did this. I brought you out of Egypt. I have the right to command you. And then the negative side, you will not have any other God before me. It's logically based on what had flowed before. Nothing was before God. He was the only God. It's an absolute command. You shall not. So many times when I was raising children, my children would play a game of mom against dad. Did you ever play that game or know any? No, you're all perfect. I forgot. But mom would say, they would say, Mom, can I do such and such? And she would say, no. And invariably, within a few seconds, they come and say, Dad, can I do such and such? And what do I say? What did your mother say? Yeah, right. I learned as a parent. That's what I had to do. You know, what part of no is hard to understand? You can't do it. You can't have anyone, and God said, before me, that is before my face. I'm the God. I'm it. There's nobody else in line here. You know, it's not like me and then other gods behind me here in a pantheon in heaven. Instead, he's saying it's just me. No one can stand before me. I am God. You must worship me. And failure to obey that commandment will lead to your destruction. The prophet Hosea in Hosea 2:14 said, speaking of this time, God saying to the people, I'll allure her. I'll bring her into the wilderness, and I'll share my heart as I speak. And the King James, I believe, uses the word tenderly to her, or gently to her. And it's literally the phrase that I will make love with my voice. You all know, don't look at me like that. You all know what that is. When you're with that love of your life, and, you know, you just, you know, you found the right person. I remember when Teresa found me, how she felt. Just the quintessence of pulchritude. It's just the greatest thing in the world. And you say these little lovey-dovey words, and
I take them all back.
Oh, okay, that's good. That's what God says. That's what I'm doing. I'm going to lure her into the wilderness and bring her to a place, and I'm not going to give her, you know, the law as some evil thing. I'm going to be giving her as my love words to you. No wonder the Jews today celebrate the Ten Commandments, the giving of Torah, as a festival, like Mardi Gras. They celebrate it as a great feast because it's such a blessing to them. So at Sinai, you see the picture here in the Old Testament. In the rest of the Old Testament, you see the same thing developing here in Hebrew history, because it's easy to worship the gods that are out there, the gods of materialism. That was the gods of the world that the Jews lived in. That's their Israel as a nation. We're still fighting against these. The god that was, well, literally had a shrine in every little city and village was called Baal, or Baal, we would say. And they would have Baal Peor, that is the Baal of that city or region of Peor, and so forth. Each one of these different gods. And Baal was this god who rode on the thunder clouds. And so whenever they'd see the clouds and the storm and the rain, and they'd see lightning flash, and they go, there's Baal, there's our god. Melkart of Tyre, Chemosh or Chemosh of Moab, Moloch that offered the infant sacrifices of the Ammonites, and Dagon, the god of the Philistines. These were the people that the Hebrew history is full of. They had gods to be worshipped of the material world that would help them. Household gods. Everybody could have gods in their own house. They could have gods and little idols. We'll be talking about that in the second commandment next week or 2 weeks from now, Lord willing. But they would have a little shelf in the corner of their house. When I was in it was then the Soviet Union back in the 70s, I went into a home in a village. And as I talked with the people there, I noticed that in the corner of their home, they had a little corner shelf. And it had icons, it had pictures, it had a little statue, it had a candle, it had a crucifix. And I thought, what exactly is this? And they said, this is our God shelf. Because that's the way people are. You know, I don't want to offend any God, so if I hear, if you got a better God than me, okay, I'll add him to the shelf, and we'll pray. And we don't want to offend any God, for sure. And of course, then you have the gods of fertility, that to make the crops grow and to make your family blessed and have male heirs and so forth, all tied to sexuality, to their farming, the prosperity, their land. Ashtoreth, the sex goddess of romance and reproduction. Tammuz, the Babylonian goddess who has a son. You'll see pictures of her all the time with a, like a little crown, called the Queen of Heaven. And she carries the little baby in her arms that died and rose again. One of the prophets said that they make cakes to the Queen of Heaven. And when you look back at the history of it, we would call them hot cross buns. It's still done today at the Lenten season by many who worship the Queen of Heaven. And Anath, A-N-A-T-H, Baal's sister, well, his mother, well, his aunt, I don't know exactly the relationship there, but that was another god who liked to kill everybody after they had relationships with them. John Calvin said the human heart is an idol factory that operates constantly. We deal with temptations, setting things before or competing with God and his preeminent place in our life. So in the Old Testament, this is a very real world. Now think about it. Now we're going to move to the New Testament, the time of Christ and the era of the church in which, you know, we still live today. Do we have other gods before the God? Does the world worship other gods? You can shake your head up and down and show you're still awake here. Yes, that's, we do. In the New Testament, we have another Mount Sinai experience. The glory of God and the majesty. The people couldn't even look. They couldn't listen. The sound of the trumpet, remember, was the trump of God was blowing in long, continuous blasts, and the people were just in awe and fear there of the glorious God that had come down. In the New Testament, God did the same. Jesus took three of his disciples up onto a mountain in Galilee. We call it the Mount of Transfiguration. And they went up there, and the disciples were just amazed. They saw the glory and the awe, and they saw Jesus transformed. The Greek word is metamorphosized, like a caterpillar into a butterfly, a human Jesus into the divine, eternal body. They were blown away, and they watched this in awe and fear, and then they heard God on the mountaintop, just like the Jews, but this time he said only one commandment. He said, "This is my beloved son. Hear what he has to say." One commandment. Do listen to him. For Jesus Christ had come to do his Father's business. John 5:19 says, not as a servant, but as God himself coming down to the mountaintop. That the first commandment is fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ. That he is God. Before Abraham was, I am, Jesus said in John 8:58. And so the people could see God. What had started at Sinai at the burning bush to Moses, and then 2 years later after the Exodus, here they all are at the back at the mountain, and again they see it. Now the people can see God as God self-reveals to the world. John writes in John 1:14 that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. That Jesus was this God. Now the Jews had a hard time getting their minds around that. That we believe in one God. And yes, God has a Messiah, a son, and God has a Ruach HaKadosh, a spirit of God. And they didn't know how to put that all together. We simply made up a word called Trinity. It's not found in the Bible. The Bible uses the word the Godhead. But it's one God, but with three distinct persons and works there together. The Jews might stumble over that, but for Christians it should not be that big of an issue. But for the disciples in the time of Jesus, Jesus was talking to the disciples after the Passover, the Lord's Supper, which we just read the passage there in John 12 and 13. Now in John 14, he's saying, I'm going to my Father's house. And Thomas asks him, how are we going to get there? And I don't know the way. And Jesus says, I'm the way. And then look at verse 8, John 14, verse 8. Philip said to him, well, Lord, okay, let's settle the deal. Lord, show us the Father, and that'll be enough. You know, Philip's just going to cut to the chase. And Jesus said to him, have I been with you for so long, almost 4 years now, and you still don't know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am the Father is me, that we are one? Even the disciples stumbled over it. They didn't understand. They'd been taught the first commandment. There's no other God. Okay, he's up in heaven somewhere in a rocking chair with a big beard, and we don't want to offend him. And here Jesus is saying, no, I am God. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you've seen the Father, you've seen me. We're all one. John writes at the end of his life in the letter in 1 John chapter 5, verse 20, we know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we can understand what's true. And we are in him who is true, his Son, Jesus Christ, who is the true God. Jesus shows that he is God, that this is not some breaking of a commandment, that this is the fulfillment, the revelation of this commandment. His incarnation was insufficient to redeem, but his atoning sacrifice would pay the price that was needed for salvation. The cross that lifted Jesus a few inches off the ground began the victory that raised him to the right hand of God where he is today. And so, hear him, the Father said, because this is God. You say, well, that's okay. If I were there, I would have believed that. Chances are, if we were there, we'd have been with the people in the crowd saying, crucify him. Stone him, do something, because he's claiming to be God. And he can't be God. God's up in heaven. But for the church that followed that after the death and burial, the resurrection and ascension of Jesus, from that point to today, the emphasis has to be where it always was on this first commandment, worship the true God. And yet, how much history has shown us that that's not what the church has done. The church is making their own God in their own image, not worshiping the God of the Bible. God's commanding an exclusive relationship. He's saying, I want you to be one of mine. God gives the gospel. Is the gospel hard to understand? Yeah, sometimes it's hard for some people. But if I said, here's the gospel. You are a sinner and deserve God's judgment in eternal hell. Jesus Christ died to pay the penalty of sin. You, by faith, believe that and repent of your sin and turn to Christ. And that's the good news. That's called the evangel, and we are evangelical. That is, we're proclaiming that simple gospel message. Yet through the years, history's not been kind to the church because the church has not been doing that. They started immediately to make up other gods. Gods of success. Constantine, the great Roman emperor and general, was fearful of a battle, and he saw in the clouds split apart and the sunbeams come through and make a cross. And said he heard a voice in his head that said, in this sign conquer. And so he said, everyone needs to be a Christian. He asked the leaders of the Christianity, how do people become a Christian? They said, well, when they believe in God and turn from the other gods and have one God and believe, then they're a Christian and we baptize them. And Constantine said, let's cut to the chase. And he went out there with basins of water and sprinkled the people to be baptized so that they'd be a Christian. Now, last time I checked, that's not how you become a Christian. But the church bought into that. Church through history has tended towards numbers, towards success, towards money, towards building, towards fame. And like Israel of old, there's too much Egypt in us. And we use different benchmarks, as it were. God says that when you put other gods of this world ahead of you, in the Old Testament, he uses words like adultery or harlotry, that you're chasing after, whoring after the gods of this world. Well, we're not. We don't have a little statue here, right? We don't even have a cross. We don't have anything here. We have a cup of coffee. Is that the god maybe of the 20th century? No, I don't know. But the church has been pressured to compromise. And today, the evangel, today, the message of the real gospel is being, well, it's almost unmentioned in Christian circles. Many churches sound like they're having the Ten Commandments of Ted Turner and not of Jesus. There are 1.3 billion people on planet Earth that claim to be Christian. If you ask them, they say, I'm a Christian. If you ask them, how did you become a Christian? About 130 million, one in 10, got to hold up the right fingers here, 1 in 10 will share that they became a Christian by being born again. 9 in 10 will give another answer. Now that's the 1.3 billion Christians. What about the 6.1 billion non-Christians? How are they getting to heaven? Well, you can start to do the math, and if by their own confession of faith that they believe in salvation by God's grace alone, that he saved them, you're looking at best at 1 out of every 65 people alive today on planet Earth that believes that. The other 64 out of 65 have another God than the God of the Bible. The other gods and the religions. One of the old time writers said that this happens because of social intercourse with other belief center systems around us. That we see people in their churches, in their religions, and it looks good. I remember one of my family members who read in the late 60s and early 70s the sayings of Buddha. You know, Gautama, the Buddha, the wise leader of Buddhism, and he said, I really love what he had to say. I'm going to follow that. Now, this is in America. Well, Colorado, almost America. The idea, it's very real. We see the rituals. We see the celebrations. We see the sacrifices. We see and hear and listen to this religion and that religion, or no religion, or the religion of man, or the religion of this nation, or whatever it is. And what does the church do? If the church wants to succeed, we've got to bring those people in. Let's change the name of the feast of Ishtar, the goddess of Babylon, and let's call it Easter. Or of the Yule celebration of the northern countries of Europe, of Norway and the Scandinavian, the Celtic lands, and we'll call it Christmas. And let's say, we got the Day of the Dead, right? All Souls Day, when the dead come out of the ground. We better change that to All Saints Day. That's when Martin Luther nailed the thesis, saying we got to change the church. This is not right. And we don't even care about either one, because it's also called Halloween. Let's get serious. Did you see the ads in the paper today for candy sales? It is the 10th of September. And so all the Halloween ads are out there for your Milky Ways and whatever it might be. No wonder God of the Old Testament told the Jews, exterminate the Canaanites, because they're gonna pollute you. They're going to entice your people to follow after other gods. I wish God would do that today. And that brings us to the final point in the world today, the application, as it were, of this message. In the history of the world, I asked the question, who's on first? And immediately I thought of an Abbott and Costello line. But, you know, it doesn't really matter who's on first. It's who we put first. That's the God. God says, no other gods in front of my face. They can't stand. There's no other God besides me. It's the battle of the world in which we live today. If we can invalidate the first commandment, we can throw out the other nine. Because if there is no God who redeems and watches and knows and will judge, then let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And I know many people who have that as the credo of their faith. Do your own thing. Enjoy life. The Epicurean, the Stoic, the Skeptic, all the different types there are there. But the Ten Commandments start out, and by the way, the Ten Commandments end, not just in Exodus 20, but they'll continue on with all sorts of commandments. And then in Exodus 32 and 33, it winds down the story. We'll get to that 10 messages from now. But it ends up in Exodus 34, 14, saying, you shall worship no other God, for the Lord God, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. So when you pray today, don't say, Our Father in heaven. Don't say, Jesus, do this, or Spirit, lead me here. His name is jealous. Dear jealous, let my life be for you alone, because if it isn't, I'm in trouble, because your name is jealous. The world defies the first commandment. The gods become the object of man's desire and man's thinking, and follow the false religions of the world. The gods that have all the power may not be the mythical gods of the pantheon of Greece or Rome. They may not be the super gods of the Norse mythology, or of the American Indians, or of the Native Islanders from the Pacific. Gods can be the powers today. And what's one of the most powerful things today on earth? Money. Money is not everything. My dad always taught me. But it ranks right up there with oxygen as what we need to live. And we bow before the almighty dollar. The people gods, the gods of the great famous people, what they say, people just hang on every word. The superhero gods, whether it's on the gridiron or the rock and roll stage or wherever it might be. The gods of education, the gods of wealth, the gods of family, the gods of possessions. The gods of the military. I mentioned earlier I was over in Russia. I got a chance to go into Lenin's tomb. Lenin had died a few years before I came, actually back in the 30s. But they have a tomb right outside the Kremlin on Red Square. And when you step into the tomb area, there's a moving sidewalk. Like you get an airport you know, follow what I'm saying? And you just stand there. And beautiful hymn-like music plays, soft and mellow organ music. And you just want to start singing "Just As I Am" without one plea. It's just beautiful. And then it goes by an open casket with the body wax-enhanced of Lennon because it decayed pretty badly. But you went by that. And I went through there, and there were Russian people on either side of me who were weeping, who reached out to just touch the glass top of the coffin. Because their God had died. People who go to the tomb of Muhammad, or to the place where the Buddha was born and had his vision under the whatever kind of tree that was in India, where it's still there, propped up and existent there. Maybe it's on Wall Street. Maybe when 9/11 occurred 16 years ago and the Islamic terrorist attacked America's God, they recognized where to attack. Attack the Capitol, attack the Pentagon, and attack the World Trade Center, power of the economy. The gods are worshipped today, but they're all man-made gods. Think of the gods of this world. The Hindus, who have Shiva and Krishna and 2,500 other gods that they worship. The Buddhists, who say there is no God, but people fall on every word of the Buddha as if he were a god. The Shintoists, who deify their ancestors. The Islam, who worship Allah, the moon goddess of the desert, with the crescent moon still as their symbol today. The Zoroastrianism, which is kind of half Hindu and half Muslim, and weird blend over there. The Zoroastrians have Ahura and Mazda as their gods. Now, I could see them having Porsche or Mercedes as a god, but Mazda? I just don't see that very well there. The Confucianism, who say Tian is a god of the heavens and nature. The Taoists, who find harmony in the yin and yang of the balance of the universe as their god. The tribal religions of the world, who teach a great spirit in the tree, in the stone, in the mountain, in the sky. And Mother Earth, we must tread softly on the bosom of Mother Earth as we walk. And the New Age, who say, I am God. And then Christianity, that says, no, there's one God. And he said, none other can stand before me. There's none other in the category. They're called gods, little g. But there's one God, the triune Godhead. So the 21st century in which we find ourselves today leads us into a modern idolatry, surpassing or melding together the religious systems of the world. Chuck Colson, in his book, Loving God, it's mostly about the great commandment, the first commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, and so, you know, okay. But he did a survey of people saying, what does it mean to love God? What is God? And he writes in his result, and this is a quotation, not only have we not given thought to what the commandment means in our present day existence, we've not tried to obey it. The warnings in Exodus, the warnings throughout the Old Testament to worship one God seem totally irrelevant to mankind today. Few bow down to idols and statues here in America, but around the world it's preeminent. In the other religions, but we have our own pyramid of the pantheon of money and power and politics and Western society has rejected the God of the Bible, and by doing so, turned to other gods. David Hunt, in the book The Seduction of Christianity, has a whole chapter called Christianized Idolatry, that Christians idolize. By the way, the first thing that he came up with on his list is our families. Now, I don't idolize my family, but have I showed you pictures of my grandkids? Let me get in the one. I can see what we do, because we've changed from worshiping the one God, the Creator, and instead worship the creation. Alan Redpath, the evangelist of another generation, said, "Our God is the thing or the person which to us is most precious, for whom we would make the greatest sacrifice, and moves our heart with the warmest love. He is the person or thing that if we lost, we'd be desolate." You can see why our kids or grandkids are in that. Maybe our husband or wife. Maybe our cat. Maybe our bank account. Martin Luther said, "Whatever we make the most of is God." How many of us even think about the one true God that says nothing else matters? Paul wrote in Philippians chapter 3, verse 18, "Many whom I've told you about, and even now speak of with tears, walk as enemies of the cross of Christ." These are people who claimed to be believers at one time. He said their end is destruction. Their God is their own belly. And they glory in their shame as they focus their minds on earthly things. Pleasure, the things of this world, like a drug, requiring more and more to get the same effect. And that's what we worship. Moses had to make the choice. I can't imagine. For 4 years, he was raised by his mother as a nursemaid and taught his heritage, taught the stories of the creation, of the flood, of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And then he was taken into the Pharaoh's court at age 5, but at age 40, he came to the realization that he would choose to be part of the people of God and worship the one true God. Choosing, Hebrews 11:25 says, to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. And he turned his back and walked away. We need to do that. Jesus said, no one can serve two masters. We only can have one God, folks. We can say with our mouth, everyone can amen me, that I believe in the true God and I'm going to follow him alone. But when the rubber hits the road, how are we going to act? How are we going to think? What are we going to do? Someone said, I have the gift of gab. I guess that's a nice thing to say about a preacher. Most people have the gift of grab. We grab everything we can and grab hold of it and hang on. And even my dollar says, in this do I trust. Oh, wait a minute, in God I trust it. But, you know, we place other things ahead. And as Paul condemns 21st century America in Romans chapter 1, verse 25, he says they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature more than the Creator. And we will face judgment because we have a God who is there, as Francis Schaeffer so ably put it, a God who cares, a God who sees, and a God who judges. So the conclusion is simple. We have one of two possibilities. Number one, we can continue to place everything in this world, our religion, our families, our ethics, our money, our whatever you want to put in there, we can put that before God. Rebelling against this first commandment and bringing eternal damnation on ourselves. Hell for the lost who have not known Christ. Judgment for the believers who will lose their reward, as we could read in 1 Corinthians 3, 11 through 14. That's a choice. We can make that choice, and that's what most people in the world are doing. Or we can say, I'm going to comply with the first commandment. And yes, I know that when I say I believe this, I'm going to have to believe all the rest. Because if I don't, it shows that I don't believe there is just one God. But if I choose that, I will be blessed. Have a perfect life? No. Go to Disneyland? No. Don't see that in the Bible. But we will be blessed in this life and in eternity to come.